I'm going to read a quote, actually, from an 1867 account of New York City, where Junius Henri Brown, who is a journalist who wrote a book about New York at that point, wrote, "To a stranger, New York must seem to be perpetually engaged in eating. Go where you will, between the hours of 8 in the morning and 6 in the evening, and you are reminded that man is a cooking animal. Tables are always spread. Knives and forks are always rattling against dishes. The odors of the kitchen are always rising." And then he asked, and this was nice for me because he gave me a title, "Is the appetite of the metropolis ever appeased?" And this is what I want to talk about today, is the creation of the appetite of the metropolis, or the links between two major shifts in 19th century New York. On the one hand, the rise of the commercial metropolis and the growth of New York into, you know, from just a relatively small port city into a very large cultural center and commercial metropolis. So that aspect on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the changing food habits in the early 19th century and their role in the creation of a consumer culture. And that's the larger issue that I'm looking at for my manuscript, is the rise of a consumer culture, looking at food as a lens or a way of getting at that understanding. Eating is such a fundamental human process that people sometimes forget that it has a history. And so food, the social rituals around food, how people get food, even what they consider food, are grounded in a context. They're grounded in a particular time and place. And in the first half of the 19th century, in New York City, that place is this commercial metropolis. And so it plays a very important role in terms of New Yorkers' food patterns. And what I'm going to talk about now is a couple of those changes. I'm going to talk about the shift from public markets being the main source of food for New Yorkers into public markets taking on more of a wholesale function and people relying more on stores, retail stores, for their food. The second is the rise of restaurants, which is a central component, actually, of my work. Again, people think that New York was born with a Zagat guide. It was not. Restaurants do have a history, and so that's the second major shift. And then a third shift, which I probably won't have that much time to talk about, but I will just sort of nod at, is the way in which eating schedules change as a result of the growth of the city, so that lunch is born. Right, when lunch didn't actually exist in the 18th century. New York has a public market system that is actually one of its oldest, one of the oldest areas of city governance over over New Yorkers' daily lives. The Dutch established the public market system in the 17th century. The British inherit it and expand it. It is the area of greatest regulation of city government in the 17th and early, well, in the colonial period, and also in the early 19th century. By 1790, New York has 6 public markets. Washington Market is the biggest. Washington Market becomes the biggest. In 1790, the biggest is Fulton Market, which is still kind of around. And the city regulates them through licenses. Butchers, for example, have to be licensed, through assizes. So there's price controls, essentially. Assizes especially apply to bread, so that when wheat prices fluctuate, people still can afford to eat bread. And they are stocked by the hinterlands of New York, so that even though you know, New York is this tiny little piece on the map, Manhattan Island actually has farms on it. Brooklyn farmers, Staten Island farmers, Connecticut farmers, and New Jersey farmers are bringing their produce into New York City to sell in the public markets. And actually, there's a food industry from a very, very early point in New York. I mean, these farmers are not just growing on a little plot of land behind their house. They actually are doing cultivation techniques. They're shipping the manure out of the city and into Long Island to get better return on their land with fertilizers. They are doing intensive agriculture. So there is a pretty actually advanced commercial agriculture going on in New York from quite an early point. And in terms of the markets, in terms of the production, I mean of the marketing side, the descriptions of the markets tend to, and that's a lot of what I, a lot of my sources actually are these city descriptions, which you find all over the place in the early 19th century. They tend to focus on two aspects of the markets. On one of these aspects is abundance, and the second aspect is diversity. And when they talk about abundance and diversity, they're talking about abundance of and diversity both of food and of people. So the markets in the early 19th century are very much celebrated as a place where all people come together, which I'm actually going to talk about in a minute. First, I want to talk about the abundance and diversity of food. So, because it's actually much more diverse than the food that food choices that we have today. So Moreau de Saint-Marie, who is a Frenchman who comes to New York at the turn of the 19th century, he counts 63 varieties of fish in the markets of New York. And that's just swimming fish. He also talks about oysters, lobsters, sea and freshwater crabs, crawfish. These are all from the local waters. Fresh and saltwater prawns, other sorts of shellfish, and the very much celebrated turtle, which was quite a delicacy. But he also found 52 kinds of animals, game, kid, bear, opossum, hare, rabbit. And if that's not enough, he has a little et cetera there. So there's additional items as well. And again, as remarkable as the range of foodstuffs in the market is the range of people that are there. All these different proprietors. You have the country people who come from the hinterlands to sell their goods in New York. You have butchers who are kind of the kings of the public markets. They have these sort of permanent stalls in the markets, whereas the country vendors just rent by the day. You have hucksters who come and buy up market produce to resell it at the end of the day. And that's actually an area where that is dominated completely by poor women. They really are the hucksters in the early 19th century. And then you have all these other, there's all these images of, you know, the rag picker and the garbage collector and the matchstick girl. And of course, certain markets are known as a gathering place on Sundays for African Americans, for free and enslaved African Americans in the New York area. Catherine Market in New York is especially known as a place, a center really of African American culture in New York, because that's where this spread out, really, African-American population gathers in one central location every week. The idea of the markets as a democratic space was very much celebrated in the early 19th century, right? This is the early republic. It's a period of the common man. The idea of the United States is this new experiment in in Republican governance. They weren't quite celebrating democracy yet. And that's reflected in this poetic description in that quote sheet that I handed around. I'm going to read these, but it's, you know, I find it's easier if you can kind of follow along. So that's that first one. This guy, T.H. Eaton, wrote all these poems. He did these rambles around New York and wrote these poetic descriptions. And this is his poetic description of the marketplace. He describes it as the place where no distinctions are, all sects and colors mingle there. Long folks and short, black folks and gray, with common bods and folks that pray. Rich folks and poor, both old and young, and good and bad and weak and strong. The wise and simple, red and white, with those that play and those that fight. The high, the low, the proud, the meek, and all one common object seek. For lady, belle, and buck and lass, here mingle in one common mass. Nothing more clear, I'll tell you why, all kinds of folks must eat or die. This, the idea of the marketplace as a democratic haven is a major theme in the descriptions of the markets and of the early 19th century. And this is a really glossy picture of market culture, because even though everybody had to eat or die, right? Even though everybody did go to the markets, they didn't necessarily go at the same time. The market produce was most expensive in the mornings, so that's when you were likeliest to find the wealthiest people there. Least expensive in the afternoons, when the wealthy people or their servants had taken away all of the choice produce. And so wealthy people and poor people wouldn't necessarily be there at the same time. Wealthy people increasingly were likely to send a servant and so wouldn't be there really at all, even though they would avail themselves of the market offerings. I mentioned that Catherine Market, for example, was a center of or a gathering place for African Americans, but only on the weekends, so that you wouldn't have, you know, at the daily market, you wouldn't have white folks and, what did they say, colored? Black folks in gray, all sects and colors mingling there. And not only was the diversity of the foodstuffs of the people overstated, so was the diversity of foodstuffs, because the markets were actually very much punctuated by periods of scarcity, and they would list all of these items that are available, but they're not necessarily available in very large quantities. So you might have 63 kinds of fish, but you might have one shad and three bass, and once they're purchased, that's the end of them for the day, and maybe even for several weeks. Starting in the 1820s is when you have these major structural shifts, technological developments, industrial developments, transportation developments, that contribute to very significant changes in New York's food supply. And that, of course, affects the markets as well. So that, and the most important development actually in early 19th century New York in terms of its markets and in terms of many other aspects as well, which you'll see because we're going to talk a lot about it in the history of New York, is the Erie Canal. Right. So when the Erie Canal opens, it connects New York, it expands New York's hinterlands all the way to the Midwest, and allows for goods from the Midwest to make it all the way to New York without spoiling, and to make it all the way to New York at a price that is so much lower than, it was just prohibitively expensive to bring heavy, like wheat, from far distances over land. Until you have the canal. But the Erie Canal and also steam transportation allows for the much quicker and cheaper carriage of food product throughout the country and into New York. You have wild game coming from the Midwest, you have salmon coming from Maine, you have pineapples coming from Barbados. I mean, all this stuff is coming in and is able to make it here without spoiling. As the quantity of goods coming into New York expands, the city government can't really keep pace with the change. And so you find that all these private shops spring up around the city, even illegal private shops spring up around the city. And there's all these private meat shops that open up, actually, as you have more and more cattle coming in from the Midwest. And the licensed butchers are very displeased by this development because, understandably, they pay fees. They're forced to pay fees in order to maintain their market stalls. And as a protection for paying these fees, the government agrees that they will make sure that if you don't pay the fees, that you can't practice the butchering trade. But the city increasingly is turning a blind eye to these practices. And if you look at the, or having looked at the minutes of the Common Council, there is just petition after petition after petition in the 1820s, in the 1830s, in the 1840s from butchers complaining about this practice and asking the government to do something about it. And the government doesn't. Of course, the New York City's municipal government is involved in other things, like stealing money by the 1850s. And so they are very much not interested in regulating their markets, which in fact line their pockets with all of these kickbacks and corruption and graft. And so they're really just a way for the corrupt government to make money in the 1840s and the 1850s. The city also, not only do they not bother regulating the markets, which is their function, but they also don't build new markets. So that as the city spreads, and you can again look at the map and see that the city is spreading up into, you know, today's Midtown, the government doesn't build new markets above 14th Street. And so you have, and most of those districts above 14th Street are residential districts. And so those people who live up there don't have access, easy access, to a public market. And so you find that there's these food shops that spring up in their neighborhoods as well to service the needs of the people who live there. So by the 1850s, In addition to its public markets, and now there's dozens of them, actually, by the 1850s, New York also has about 500 private meat shops and over 2,200 retail groceries. And in the 1843, actually, the city decides to institutionalize its blind eye, and they actually remove the monopoly of the butchers for the public market. So they legalize the private meat shops. And so you're going to have an expansion between 1843 and the 1850s in terms of the private meat shops. By the mid-1860s, you have over 5,000 private groceries in New York. And by the 1850s, most New Yorkers, or many New Yorkers, are more, especially those who live at a distance from the markets, are much more likely to go to the private food shops than they are to go to the public markets. Not only are groceries more convenient if there's one near your house, but they also have services that the public markets don't. They're open later. The public markets close at 2 p.m. The groceries are open, in some cases, until 10 at night. And they provide services like delivery service. They extend credit, which is very desirable in the 1850s. Lots of people buying things on credit. And they also, increasingly, the groceries take on the kind of civic role that the markets had taken on in an earlier period. So they serve kind of as neighborhood centers. The public markets, neglected by the city, take on more and more criticism. And the groceries, which actually in the 1830s are much maligned, the groceries start to become more respectable. And I say in the 1830s they're much maligned because in the 1830s a grocery is sort of a glorified liquor store or even a bar. Groceries had a sort of a shady reputation, but they're shedding that shady reputation by the mid-19th century, especially if they're in certain neighborhoods. I always like to quote this New York Times article. This is the next quote on the quote sheet, who describes the markets in 1860, quite different from the celebratory descriptions of an earlier period. He writes, "During the last 12 years, the writer has been forced by business to resort diurnally to these depots of fish, flesh, and fowl." Forced. "On each successive Saturday, this duty is effected at the risk of his limbs, and on every other day of the week with the loss of his temper and the damage of his clothes. Bloody carcasses and ungainly chopping blocks are so peripatetic as to render it simply miraculous for a well-dressed man or a properly clad woman." Now, this is a class marker as well, right? "To pass through unscathed in person or apparel. And then again, so inconveniently are they arranged and so unsystematically are they crowded that none but the most expert ever succeeded to reaching the same point twice without the aid of a guide." So there's this idea the markets now are not celebrated. They are crowded, they are chaotic, they are dirty, they are unsanitary, and they are not a place for a proper, refined person. And that actually is kind of reflected visually in these images that I passed around here. So I'm sorry, the top one is not very good because this is an old picture that I made a photocopy of. Okay, well, thank you, Marie. So in the middle is Washington Market in the 1860s. Washington Market in the 1860s is the biggest market in New York. It is a central wholesale market as well. And in fact, it is today's Tribeca. Right, so Tribeca is Washington Market. In fact, that's what it was called until it was called Tribeca, that area of the city. And Washington Market is the central market in the city until it is replaced, actually, by Hunts Point, when trucks become more, or when that's the conveyance for foods. But this gives you a sense, this middle picture of Washington Market, of the chaos of the market. So all these carts, buildings are not very well kept. They look like shacks. And the bottom picture actually is just to give you an image of how large Washington Market is. I don't know where they went. We copied 10, so there should be. So the bottom, again, is just to show you how big Washington Market was. It really took up pretty much the whole neighborhood. On the top is an image of a confectioner's shop. So this is a private food shop, and you really can see the difference between the interior private food shop and the exterior public market. It is, you know, the way that the people are dressed, the woman and her child, again, these are class markers. The counters are very neat. Everything is organized. It seems like a much more pleasant shopping environment than what you find in Washington Market. So this is, again, a visual depiction of these descriptions. There are so many complaints about the state of the public markets in the 1840s and 50s, actually, that they start to, the press, politicians start to ask that the, reform politicians, that the markets be privatized, that they actually, the city is stripped of its functions, and this is a process that's happening in other areas in New York as well in the 1850s. But while that idea takes off in some places, like Philadelphia actually, they privatize their markets, it doesn't actually ever really take hold in New York. So even today, actually, New York City regulates its public markets. Obviously the markets don't go away, but they do shift in function. So increasingly, the markets, which had been both wholesale and retail in the 18th century, by the mid-19th century, are a wholesale center. Shipping all over the world, actually, all over the country, and places where hoteliers and restaurateurs come and shop, or grocers come and do their shopping, but most New Yorkers rely on retail stores, as I said before, for their daily needs. So that's a real shift, and it shows us as the city grows in geographic extent, the way that people are getting their food, the way the food is being marketed, is shifting by the mid-19th century. And the second area where we see that, as I mentioned before, is in the rise of restaurants. And as I said, people, you know, it's hard to imagine a time when New York had no restaurants, because New York is a restaurant city. But actually, there were no restaurants in New York until the 19th century. The only public commercial place where you would be served a meal is a tavern. And they weren't freestanding restaurants. The tavern was attached to a hostelry, and most of the people who ate their meals in taverns were travelers. The idea of going out to eat didn't really exist. The first freestanding restaurants in New York come in the 18-teens, 1820s, and then in the 1830s you see an explosion of freestanding restaurants. So that the 1830s, they're numbering in the thousands. By the Civil War, you have over 5,000 restaurants of all different kinds in New York. And this also is linked to the growth of the city, right? Necessity is the mother of invention. So that you have an expanded population, you have a population that is living in an expanded area, and men who are now commuting to work can't return home for all of their meals as they would have done in an earlier period, when not only are home and work close in the walking city, in most cases they're in the same structure, so that people, you know, home and work are not, well, this is classic women's history actually, home and work are not separated before the industrial period. So you have an increased demand from business, from workers of various levels. There's more and more people coming to New York for traveling to New York from outside, whether that's for business purposes or for pleasure, and they start to demand restaurants as well. And also, this is when New York's housing crunch begins in the early 19th century, so that the expanding population is not greeted with affordable housing or any housing at all. And so hotels start to open in New York in very large numbers in the 1830s, and over half of those hotel rooms in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s are occupied by permanent residents of New York who can't find a home. And they don't want to eat every single meal in the hotel dining room, and so they start to demand freestanding restaurants as well. The first freestanding restaurants that emerge in New York are for businessmen. So I'm going to talk about them in a minute, actually. But by the 19th century, you have a huge variety in these thousands of public dining options. One writer said, described them as ranging from the elegance and costliness of Delmonico's, which was the restaurant that introduced fine dining to New York, to the subterranean sites where men are fed like swine and dirt is served gratis in unhomeopathic doses. So those are the extremes. You have Delmonico's with the finest appointments, the French menu, and then you have free dirt. And then in between these extremes, you can find all of these other options as well. Chop houses, oyster cellars, which New York was, I mean, oyster cellars are like the pizza places of New York today. They're on every corner. People, they're very much associated with New York City. Ice cream parlors, you have coffee shops, and also there's all these food vendors, right? So we have, that goes back a long ways as well. So you have hot corn vendors, roast pork vendors, the apple girls, ice cream stands on the street. So this New York is becoming a food city now at this point in time. The poorest New Yorkers could not afford to these food options, but everyone else could. So that there is, except for the poorest New Yorkers, and really the most downtrodden of New York's population, which is significant, everyone else could partake of some type of public dining option by the 1840s, and they did. And they increasingly did as the 19th century progressed. And as the 19th century progresses, also entrepreneurs see a demand in various areas, and they accommodate these demands. And two examples of this are, one, the short order house for businessmen, and the second are the ladies' lunchrooms that emerge in the mid-19th century. So first I'll talk about the short order houses briefly, and then I'll briefly talk about the ladies' lunchrooms. I love to talk about the short order houses because they're so New York, actually. Even, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, we see this kind of throwing food down really quickly, running out. You know, the idea of New York as a commercial place where you just can't waste time sitting and enjoying your food. You just eat it as fast as you can. They're not a place for dining. They're a place for just filling your stomach, essentially. And that's what they hope to do. They emerge in the 1820s. They're all around the business area of the city, the Wall Street area. And they provide a 20-minute lunch to the merchants and the clerks and the other white-collar workers who work nearby. Some of these men, actually most of these men, eat at some form of diner, which essentially is what these are, daily. I came across an architect's account book at the New York Historical Society, and he had every single day he records that he spends 12 and a half cents for lunch. Yes, in 1841. Yeah, today 12 and a half cents will buy you nothing. Save it for a week and you could get, I don't know, a Wrigley's. The downtown eating houses, this is the last quote, this is a description of them. Crowded, chaotic, fast, loud, they're really quite the experience. And that last quote is from Captain Basil Hall, who comes and visits New York. He's an Englishman, and he describes the Plate House, one of these short order houses. And I'm not actually going to read the whole thing, but he talks about the how loud it was in there, this amazing clatter of knives and forks. We couldn't hear anything. He writes, not a word audible to us was spoken by any of the guests. He talks about the kind of ballet of the waiters gliding up and down, inclining their heads one way and another to these booths where people are making their orders. And then they scream out the order. Not quite what, you know, those sort of creative descriptions that we see in the movies with the diners, I don't know, you know, two clouds on a raft, but close. And then within seconds, the order will be delivered by, he calls them, urchins, imps, gnomes, or whatever name they deserve. And then he concludes that we were not in the house above 20 minutes, but we sat out two sets of company at least. So these are, again, very fast meals. And they were not known for their food. George Foster, who is a very often quoted journalist who wrote all these exposés of New York life in the 19th century described them as, quote, generally bad enough, unquote, and marveled at how men of refined tastes and pampered habits who at home are as fastidious as luxury and a delicate appetite can make them find it in their hearts or stomachs either to gorge such disgusting masses of stringy meat and tepid vegetables and to go about their business again under the fond delusion that they have dined. But despite the disgustingness of the environment and the food, these are very, very popular and they thrive in New York because they fill a very important need in the growing city for these men who don't, who can't return home for the midday meal as they would have in an earlier generation. They are not, however, the proper environment for a refined lady. And ladies, middle-class women, elite women, who also are living on the edges of the city in middle-class districts, they don't work outside of the house for, you know, in a commercial area, but they shop. And so they start to demand that there be a place where they can go and maintain their refined status and not have to be around men who are spitting on the floor and bolting their food and screaming and yelling and all of this, you know, horrible environment of these short order houses and other restaurants of the business district. And so in the 1840s, they start to open ladies' lunchrooms. There's two very famous ones in New York, Taylor's and Thompson's. And they are a place where a lady of refinement can go and enjoy a meal when she is shopping in the downtown district. And the Taylor's, which was the most famous of these, actually opens across the street from A.T. Stewart's Marble Palace, which is the first department store to open in New York City. It was actually located across from City Hall, so on Chambers and Broadway. Today it's a Duane Reade. Modell's, it's a Modell's and a Duane Reade. And they have all these rules in the ladies' lunchroom so that, because, you know, as you have this these expanded categories, there are women carry the gentility with them, right? Men can maintain refinement even in a place where there's drinking going on or there's spitting on the floor or there's women stripping their clothes off. And all those things are happening in New York at this time in the public dining establishments. But ladies cannot. And so there is, you know, there's this need for a very protected space, and the ladies' lunchrooms provide that. So men are not allowed in them unless they're escorted by a woman. There's actually separate dining rooms for men only in the ladies' lunchrooms. And they are extraordinarily well appointed so that they mimic, in order to make a more comfortable space for ladies, they mimic the appointments of her parlor. So you have the lush draperies and the marble flooring and the very fancy tables, and also gendered food choices. So the ladies' lunchrooms do not serve stringy meat and tepid vegetables. They serve omelets and salads and oysters served in certain ways that are appropriate for ladies. They also are extraordinarily successful in filling this need for, you know, for maintaining gender conventions in the and also eating in the growing city. This is a description of Taylor's Saloon. Actually, and they were called saloons, which is interesting. Later on, so as were the ice cream parlors. I did some work on ice cream elsewhere. The ice cream parlors were originally called saloons, but they changed the name to parlor, right? This is also, because ice cream parlors also are a place that is a comfortable space for women. So here's this description. Among the many handsome and expensive stores in the Broadway, Taylor's Saloon carries off the palm from all the rest by the splendor of its furniture and appointments, which seem rather suited to a fairy palace than a sublunary cafe and restaurant. So these are a whole new, I mean, the market shift in function, right? But the restaurants are a whole new social institution that emerge, and this is why I do so much work on them, because they provide a whole canvas, a whole stage, if you will, for this new performance of class and, I mean, the performance of class isn't new, but the performance of class in these commercial institutions. So it's not just that more people are eating out as the city grows. It's also that they act as backdrops for this kind of historian Karen Haltonen calls the genteel performance that occurs. She talks about the private parlor, but it also happens in these more public parlors of the restaurants. And as I said, we see urban growth link up with changing food habits in other areas as well, and the most glaring one of these is the change in the schedule. So before, when families ate all of their meals together and work and home space were close or in the same structure, the biggest meal of the day, then as now, was dinner. But dinner occurred in the middle of the day. And then supper occurred, a small supper occurred in the evening. But as men are away, and women also are away from the house, and middle-class children increasingly are going to school, and the family is all separated, they start to move the largest meal of the day back into the evening at the end of the workday, but it keeps its name, dinner. So dinner becomes the evening meal, and then they invent a new name for the midday meal, which is just a small meal to kind of get you through the day until you get to the larger meal at night, and that is, of course, the birth of lunch. And the dining room, also a new space for middle-class people, becomes a place of socialization for middle-class children, not only in terms of table. That's what we call it, right? Not only in terms of table manners, but also in terms of general manners, etiquette and behaviors. So this is another area. And another area, of course, is the changing idea of the grocer, right, which I mentioned earlier. So the growth of New York contributes to very significant changes in eating patterns and the emergence of a consumer culture as people are increasingly removed from the processing and preparation of their food. So urbanization is not just a bigger town, right? I mean, it's actually changed relations, changes to the very nature of daily life that we can see reflected in these examples. And we can see the roots of our consumer culture and our urban eating patterns reflected in these examples as well. So we tend to shop at local groceries. We don't go to the big terminal markets to buy our food. We eat. Probably most of us, if we're typical New Yorkers, eat most of our meal, not most of, but eat many more meals out in restaurants than the average American does. The evening meal is a family meal, right, is another thing that we've inherited. And the service and food industry is really central to New York City's identity, is also where we see that today. So I'm going to finish the talk by answering the question that opened the talk. Is the appetite of the metropolis ever appeased? The answer is no. It never was. It demands to be fed even as the metropolis continues to grow. Thank you. Thank you.